Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. In today's episode, we will be discussing part 1 of chapter 17, and then we'll be reading part 2 of chapter 17 of Wuthering Heights. I do apologise to those who mentioned that they preferred doing whole chapters regardless of the length. There was a bit of a divide there, and I mean, that was obviously going to be the case. Some people will prefer to break the chapters up into smaller chunks if they're particularly long. Some people will prefer to power through. And to be honest, my preference changes sort of depending on the day. Like, you know, it depends how much time you've got on your hands or how much energy you've got on your brain battery thingy. In this case, yeah, I decided to break it up. So I apologize if you're a bit impatient. To keep moving on. It's just a case of, like, when they're long chapters and long discussions, the making of the podcast can take, well, you know, if the episode goes for an hour, it's going to take me at least sort of an hour and 20 minutes to do everything, you know, record it, edit it, post it, you know, that kind of stuff. Every day I can't really afford that amount of time every single day. Whereas with War and Peace, when we did that, it was more like 30 to 45 minutes a day. And like, that's an okay, like, that's a hobby that you can, that I could at least keep up. It wasn't like cutting into other things that I had to do. That's the reasoning behind it. I think it's kind of probably a bit of a no-brainer that, like, If it's taking up too much time and I don't feel like I've got time to do it, then I'm rushing it and it becomes a bit like a chore at that point, right? That's just not going to make for good entertainment for you guys if I'm sort of dragging myself through it. So I didn't want this to become something that, I never dislike doing it. I really enjoy doing it. But sometimes, you know, when you feel like, oh, I don't really have time to be doing this thing right now, I didn't want to, like, vicariously pass that sentiment on to you sort of thing. With that said, that's my excuse. I'm sticking to it. Let us move on and read some comments about part 1 of chapter 17. Techrific came in with the vocab needed for part 1. Allayed means to diminish or put to rest. Coveting means to yearn or yearn to possess. Orisons are prayers. Kirkyard is New England, North England, Scotland. Churchyard or graveyard. I did not know that. There you go. Snuffers. Sounds very ominous. Snuffers. A small hollow cone on the end of a handle used to extinguish a candle. Doleful. Expressing sorrow. Screen means shelter from drafts. Evinced is indicated or revealed, casement, window. Staunchion is an upright bar, beam, or post used as a support. Odious, arousing or deserving hatred or loathing. Preterhuman means beyond that which is human, especially superhuman. Purport, appear to be or do something, especially falsely. Murthering is an archaic way to say murder. Supplication means a plea or appeal, and succour is help and support in times of need or distress. Techrific also said, "Poor Isabella, do you think she'll make a run for it? I think so, but where can she go without anything to support herself? She's not been brought up to work, so her situation is very precarious, but she's desperate, and now that Heathcliff has become violent with her, I see no redemption possible between them. So, run she will, but the question is where?" And also, eventually Heathcliff thrives. How can he possibly get there from his current position? That's the question I asked. It seems to me, says Techrific, all he has to do is wait until the inevitable demise of Hindley, who is drinking himself to death. He's been gambling with Hindley, and I wouldn't put it past him to trick Hindley in some manner to bet the Wuthering Heights estate. Techrific also asked, question, although less sonic, did Isabella indicate that she was pregnant too, growing fat, as she put it? Where can she go if she's not intending to stay at the Grange? All about Alice said, we know that Heathcliff and Isabella have a son together, since that's who Catherine too eventually marries, I think we can assume that she just might be pregnant. I'm trying to figure out if this that will make them like cousins or something. I can't do the maths. JMama8779 said, if she doesn't get going on, I'm betting Linton returns her. It seems that Wuthering Heights is essentially in Heathcliff's hands. I'm more curious how he acquires the Grange. I will say, though, Isabella could have been rid of him had she left it alone and let Hindley do the dirty work. Wasm said, knowing what we do now of the characters, it is interesting going back to the second chapter. Oh, you would intimate that her spirit has taken the post of ministering angel and guards the fortunes of Wuthering Heights, even when her body is gone. Is that it? Mrs. Heathcliff is my daughter-in-law, said Heathcliff, corroborating my surmise. He turned as he spoke, a peculiar look in her direction, a look of hatred. So we know more or less what happens to Isabella, though there's still quite a few years to go for the narrative to catch up to Lockwood's present. What happened to her? Oh, right, sorry. That's a quote from the second chapter. Heathcliff refers to Mrs. Heathcliff as his daughter-in-law. Right. Yep, cool. It's all too confusing. I need a family tree. I think it might be about time, or we must be getting near to the time that we can bust out that family tree spoiler-free. Right? We've got to be getting close. Someone who has read this book before, let us know if we can now refer to the family tree without spoiling the book. That's the entirety of the conversation we had about chapter 17. But you know what I forgot to ask that I was meaning to ask? I had a few standout lines in the first half of chapter 17, a few lines that were particularly pithy or, I don't know, they had a nice sentiment to them. So I was going to ask, what was your favourite line from that half of the chapter? But you know what, I'll ask it at the end of this chapter for the whole chapter. What was your favourite line or lines from chapter 17? That'll be one of the questions for today's discussion. The other thing that I was just thinking last night, which I should mention on the podcast, the next book we're reading, The Brothers Karamazov, is long. It's long. Like, it's, I think it's about half of the word count of War and Peace. It's something like 900 pages long. So it's a book, right? Like, it's a big book, but it doesn't have that many chapters. The chapters are really, really long. So we are definitely going to be taking that book slow. So moving into Brothers Karamazov, just be forewarned that we're looking at, I would say, 6 months of reading on that book. Because I think it's more than half the length of War and Peace. And War and Peace took us a year, and I think that moved at a good pace. Because you've got to think, well, I've got to think, especially because I'm the one doing it every day on the microphone, I've got to think, like, what's an amount that's not just doable for a day or a week or a month, but for 6 months every single day? So I can't be on the mic reading an hour and a half of worth of a chapter every night. It's just too exhausting, honestly. With my, you know, my personal situation going on financially and everything, you know, people have lives. I'm sitting down to do this at the end of a very busy, very long day, and not that I dislike doing it, but an hour and a half is just, it's too much. Like, it's just far too much. So we are going to be breaking that down into chunks. So that's just forewarning what's going to happen with The Brothers Karamazov. I think it will move at a better pace that way. I think it will be a more thorough and more enjoyable thing. I think my perspective on this is, like, you read a comfortable amount each day. It's not a race to finish as many books as you can in a year or anything like that. It is to slowly, at, you know, 5 or 10 pages a day, make your way through this list. So when the chapters stretch on for 30, 40 or 50 pages, we'll be slicing them up. Anyway, let us move forward. I just thought I'd say that because I was thinking that last night and I thought I'll say it before, like, you know, before I forget. This, right now, is part 2 of chapter 17 of Wuthering Heights. This morning, when I came down, about half an hour before noon, Mr. Earnshaw was sitting by the fire, deadly sick. His evil genius, almost as gaunt and ghastly, leant against the chimney. Neither appeared inclined to dine, and having waited till all was cold on the table, I commenced alone. Nothing hindered me from eating heartily, and I experienced a certain sense of satisfaction and superiority as, at intervals, I cast a look towards my silent companions, and felt the comfort of a quiet conscience within me. After I had done, I ventured on the usual liberty of drawing near the fire, going round Earnshaw's seat, and kneeling in the corner beside him. Heathcliff did not glance my way, and I gazed up and contemplated his features almost as confidently as they had been turned to stone. His forehead, though that I once thought so manly, and that I now think so diabolical, was shaded with a heavy cloud, his basilisk eyes were nearly quenched by sleeplessness, and weeping perhaps for the lashes were wet then. His lips devoid of their ferocious sneer and sealed in an expression of unspeakable sadness. Had it been another, I would have covered my face in the presence of such grief. In his case, I was gratified and ignoble, as it seems to insult a fallen enemy. I couldn't miss the chance of sticking in a dart. His weakness was the only time when I could taste the delight of paying wrong for wrong. "Fie, fie, miss," I interrupted. "One might suppose you had never opened a Bible in your life. If God afflict your enemy, surely that ought to suffice you. It is both mean and presumptuous to add your torture to his." "In general, I'll allow that it would be, Allan," she concluded. "But what misery laid on Heathcliff could content me, unless I have a hand in it. I'd rather he suffered less, if I might cause his sufferings, and he might know that I was the cause. Oh, I owe him so much. On only one condition I can hope to forgive him. It is, I may take an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. For every wrench of agony, return a wrench. Reduce him to my level. As he was the first to injure, make him the first to implore pardon, and then, why, then, Allan, I might show you some generosity. But it is utterly impossible. I can ever be revenged, and therefore I cannot forgive him." Hindley wanted some water, and I handed him a glass and asked him how he was. "Not as ill as I wish," he replied, "but leaving out my arm, every inch of me is as sore as if I had been fighting a legion of imps." "Yes, no wonder," was my next remark. "Catherine used to boast that she stood between you and bodily harm. She meant that certain persons would not hurt you for fear of offending her. It's well people don't really rise from their grave, or last night she might have witnessed a repulsive scene, and are not you bruised and cut over your chest and shoulders?" "Can I say?" he answered. "But what do you mean? Did he dare to strike me when I was down?" "He trampled on and kicked you and dashed you on the ground," I whispered, "and his mouth watered to tear you with his teeth, because he is only half man, not so much, and the rest fiend." Mr. Earnshaw looked up, like me, to the countenance of our mutual foe, who, absorbed in his anguish, seemed insensible to anything around him. The longer he stood, the plainer his reflections revealed their blackness through his features. "Oh, if God would but give me strength to strangle him in my last agony, I'd go to hell with joy," groaned the impatient man, writhing to rise and sinking back in despair, convinced of his inadequacy for the struggle. "Nay, it's enough that he has murdered one of you," I observed aloud. "At the Grange, everyone knows your sister would have been living now had it not been for Mr. Heathcliff. After all, it is perfectly preferable to be hated than loved by him. When I recollect how happy we were, how happy Catherine was before he came, I'm fit to curse the day." "Most likely," Heathcliff noticed, more the truth of what was said than the spirit of the person who said it. His attention was roused. I saw, for his eyes rained down tears among the ashes, and he drew his breath in suffocating sighs, I stared full at him and laughed scornfully. The clouded windows of hell flashed a moment towards me. The fiend which usually looked out, however, was so dimmed and drowned that I did not fear to hazard another sound of derision. "Get up and be gone out of my sight," said the mourner. I guessed he uttered those words at least, though his voice was hardly intelligible. "I beg your pardon," I replied, "but I loved Catherine too, and her brother requires attendance, which for her sake I shall supply. Now, that she's dead, I see her in Hindley. Hindley has exactly her eyes. If you had not tried to gouge them out, and made them black and red, and... her... Get up, wretched idiot, before I stamp you to death," he cried, making a movement that caused me to make one also. But then I continued, holding myself ready to flee, "If poor Catherine had trusted you, and assumed the ridiculous, contemptible, degrading title of Mrs. Heathcliff, she would soon have presented a similar picture. She wouldn't have borne your abominable behaviour," quietly, abominable behaviour quietly, "her detestation and disgust must have found voice." The back of the settle and Earnshaw's person interposed between me and him, so instead of endeavouring to reach me, he snatched a dinner knife from the table and flung it at my head. It struck beneath my ear, and stopped the sentence I was uttering, but, pulling it out, I sprang to the door and delivered another, which I hope went a little deeper than his missile. The last glimpse I caught of him was a furious rush on his part, checked by the embrace of his host, and both fell locked together on the hearth. In my flight through the kitchen, I bid Joseph speed to his master. I knocked over Harriton, who was hanging a litter of puppies from a chair back in the doorway, and blessed as a soul escaped from purgatory, I bounded, leaped, and flew down the steep road, then, quitting its windings, shot direct across the moor, rolling over banks and wading through marshes, precipitating myself, in fact, towards the beacon light of the Grange, and far rather would I be condemned to a perpetual dwelling in the infernal regions than ever for one night abide beneath the roof of Wuthering Heights again. Isabella ceased speaking and took a drink of tea. Then she rose, and bidding me put on her bonnet and a great shawl I had brought, and turning a deaf ear to my entreaties for her to remain another hour, she stepped on to a chair, kissed Edgar and Catherine's portraits, bestowed a similar salute on me, and ascended to the carriage, accompanied by Fanny, who yelped with wild joy at recovering her mistress. She was driven away, never to revisit this neighbourhood, but a regular correspondence was established between her and my master when things were more settled. I believe her new abode was in the south, near London. There she had a son born a few months subsequent to her escape. He was christened Linton, and from the first she reported him to be an ailing, peevish creature. Mr. Heathcliff, meeting me one day in the village, inquired where she lived. I refused to tell. He remarked that it was not of any moment, only she must beware of coming to her brother. She should not be with him, if he had to keep herself. Though I would give no information, he discovered through some of the other servants both her place of residence and the existence of the child. Still he didn't molest her, for which forbearance she might thank his aversion, I suppose. He often asked about the infant when he saw me, and on hearing its name smiled grimly and observed, "They wish me to hate it too, do they?" "I don't think they wish you to know anything about it," I answered. "But I'll have it," he said, "when I want it. They may reckon on that." Fortunately, its mother died before the time arrived, some 13 years after the decease of Catherine, when Linton was 12, or a little more. On the day succeeding Isabella's unexpected visit, I had no opportunity of speaking to my master. He shunned conversation and was fit for discussing nothing. When I could get him to listen, I saw it pleased him that his sister had left her husband, whom he abhorred with an intensity which the mildness of his nature would scarcely seem to allow. So deep and sensitive was his aversion that he refrained from going anywhere where he was likely to see or hear of Heathcliff. Grief and that together transformed him into a complete hermit. He threw up his office of magistrate, ceased even to attend church, avoided the village on all occasions, and spent a life of entire seclusion within the limits of his park and grounds, only varied by solitary rambles on the moors, and visits to the grave of his wife, mostly at evening, or early morning before other wanderers were abroad. But he was too good to be thoroughly unhappy. Long, he didn't pray for Catherine's soul to haunt him. Time brought resignation and a melancholy sweeter than common joy. He recalled her memory with ardent, tender love and hopeful, aspiring to the better world, where he doubted not she was gone. And he had earthly consolation and affections also. For a few days, I said, he seemed regardless of the puny successor to the departed. That coldness melted as fast as snow in April, and ere the tiny thing could stammer a word or totter a step, it wielded a despot's scepter in his heart. It was named Catherine, but he never called it the name in full, as he had never called the first Catherine short, probably because Heathcliff had a habit of doing so. The little one was always Cathy. It formed to him a distinction from the mother, and yet a connection with her, and his attachment sprang from its relation to her, far more than from its being his own. I used to draw a comparison between him and Hindley Earnshaw, and perplex myself to explain satisfactorily why their conduct was so opposite in similar circumstances. They had both been fond husbands, and were both attached to their children, and I could not see how they shouldn't have taken the same road for good or evil, but I thought in my mind Hindley, with apparently the stronger head, has shown himself sadly the worse and the weaker man. When his ship struck, the captain abandoned his post, and the crew, instead of trying to save her, rushed into riot and confusion, leaving no hope for their luckless vessel. Linton, on the contrary, displayed the true courage of a loyal and faithful soul. He trusted God, and God comforted him. One hoped, and the other despaired. They chose their own lots and were righteously doomed to endure them. But you'll not want to hear my moralizing, Mr. Lockwood. You'll judge as well as I can all these things, at least you'll think you will, and that's the same. The end of Earnshaw was what might have been expected. It followed fast on his sisters. There was scarcely 6 months between them. We at the Grange never got a very succinct account of his state preceding it. All that I did learn was on occasion of going to aid in the preparations for the funeral. Mr. Kenneth came to announce the event to my master. "Well, Nelly," said he, riding into the yard one morning, too early not to alarm me with an instant presentiment of bad news, "it's yours and my turn to go into mourning at present. Who's given us the slip now, do you think?" "Who?" I asked in a flurry. "Why, guess," he returned, dismounting and slinging his bridle on a hook by the door. "And nip up the corner of your apron. I'm certain you'll need it." "Not Mr. Heathcliff, surely," I exclaimed. "What, would you have tears for him?" said the doctor. "No, Heathcliff's a tough young fellow. He looks blooming today. I've just seen him. He's rapidly regaining flesh since he lost his better half." "Who is it, then?" "Mr. Kenneth," I repeated impatiently. "Hindley Earnshaw, your old friend Hindley," he replied, "and my wicked gossip, though he's been too wild for me this long. There," I said, "we should draw water. But cheer up, he died true to his character, drunk as a lord. Poor lad. I'm sorry, too. One can't help missing an old companion, though he had the worst tricks with him that ever man imagined, and has done me many a rascally turn." "He's barely 27, it seems. That's your own age. Who would have thought you were born in 1 year?" I confess this blow was greater to me than the shock of Mrs. Linton's death. Ancient associations lingered round my heart. I sat down in the porch and wept as for a blood relation, desiring Mr. Kenneth to get another servant to introduce him to the master. I could not hinder myself from pondering on that question. Had he had fair play? Whatever I did, that idea would bother me. It was so tiresomely pertinacious that I resolved on requesting leave to go to Wuthering Heights and assist in the last duties to the dead. Mr. Linton was extremely reluctant to consent, but I pleaded, eloquently, for the friendless condition in which he lay, and I said my old master and foster brother had a claim on my services as strong as his own. Besides, I reminded him that the child Harriton was his wife's nephew, and in the absence of nearer kin, he ought to act as its guardian, and he ought to and must inquire how the property was left, and look over the concerns of his brother-in-law. He was unfit for attending to such matters then, but he bid me to speak to his lawyer, and at length permitted me to go. His lawyer had been Earnshaw's also. I called at the village and asked him to accompany me. He shook his head and advised that Heathcliff should be let alone, affirming, if the truth were known, Harriton would be found little else than a beggar. His father died in debt, he said. A whole property is mortgaged, and the sole chance for the natural heir is to allow him to an opportunity of creating some interest in the creditor's heart, that he may be inclined to deal leniently towards him. When I reached the Heights, I explained that I had come to see everything carried on decently, and Joseph, who appeared in sufficient distress, expressed satisfaction at my presence. Mr. Heathcliff said he did not perceive that I was wanted, but I might stay and order the arrangements of the funeral if I chose. Correctly, he remarked, that fool's body should he be buried at the crossroads without ceremony of any kind. I happened to leave him 10 minutes yesterday afternoon, and in that interval he fastened the two doors of the house against me, and he has spent the night in drinking himself to death deliberately. We broke in this morning, for we heard him sporting like a horse, and there he was laid over the settle, flaying and scalping would not have weakened him. I sent for Kenneth, and he came, but not till the beast had changed into carrion. He was both dead and cold, and stark, and so you allow it was useless making more stir about him. The old servant confirmed this statement, but muttered, "I'd rather ye'd gone hissel for doctor. I should ha' ta'en tent o' maister better nor him, and he warn't dead when I left, nor aught o' the sort." I insisted on the funeral being respectable. Mr. Heathcliff said I might have my own way there, too, only he desired me to remember that the money for the whole affair came out of his pocket. He maintained a hard, careless deportment, indicative of neither joy nor sorrow. If anything, he expressed a flinty gratification at a piece of difficult work successfully executed. I observed once, indeed, something like exultation in this aspect. It was just when the people were bearing the coffin from the house. He had the hypocrisy to represent a mourner, and previous to following with Harriton, he lifted the unfortunate child onto the table and muttered with peculiar gusto, "Now, my bonny lad, you are mine, and we'll see if one tree won't grow as crooked as another, with the same wind to twist it." The unsuspecting thing was pleased at this speech. He played with Heathcliff's whiskers and stroked his cheek, but I divined its meaning and observed tartly, "That boy must go back with me to Thrushcross Grange, sir. There is nothing in the world less yours than he is." "Does Linton say so?" he demanded. "Of course, he has ordered me to take him," I replied. "Well," said the scoundrel, "well, we'll not argue the subject now, but I have a fancy to try my hand at rearing a young one so intimate to your master that I must supply the place of this with my own, if he attempt to remove it. I don't engage to let Harriton go undisputed, but I'll be pretty sure to make the other come. Remember to tell him." This hint was enough to bind our hands. I repeated its substance on my return, and Edgar Linton, little interested at the commencement, spoke no more of interfering. I am not aware that he could have done it to any purpose, had he been ever so willing. The guest was now the master of Wuthering Heights. He held firm possession and proved to the attorney, who in his turn proved it to Mr. Linton, that Earnshaw had mortgaged every yard of land he owned for cash to supply his mania for gaming, and he, Heathcliff, was the mortgagee. In that manner, Harriton, who should now be the first gentleman in the neighbourhood, was reduced to a state of complete dependence on his father's inveterate enemy, and lives in his own house as a servant, deprived of the advantage of wages, quite unable to right himself because of his friendlessness and his ignorance that he has been wronged. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Grim stuff. Have your say about Chapter 17, Part 2, over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I'll leave a few questions for you to discuss. I look forward to reading your thoughts. Thanks for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.